Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for March 15th and 16th, 2013. This teaching is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. themessianicmessage.com. I hope this teaching will be a blessing to you. This week's Torah portion is Vayikra, but before we get started, let's say a prayer. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech HaOlam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. We thank you and praise you. Holy is your name. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and may your will be done in our lives as it is in heaven. I pray, Abba, bless your people on this Shabbat, wherever they are on the earth, and protect us as we go through all of the challenges that we know are coming. I ask that you would speak in this Torah portion, that whatever is spoken would not be of me, but would be of you, and that all my words would fall and die, and that your word would prosper and would not come back void. I ask these things, and I thank you and praise you for allowing me to do this work for your kingdom, Abba. I just thank you and praise you in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Vayikra. It is Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 6, verse 7. The Haftarah is Isaiah 43, verse 21 to chapter 44, verse 23. And the Brit Hadashah is Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 to 18. Vayikra means, "And he called." What that is telling us is what happened in the first verse. The Lord called to someone. He called to Moses. So, "and he called" means that the Lord called to Moses, and he gave instructions to Moses, which were then to be repeated to the children of Israel about how to approach him, how to approach the tabernacle, and how to approach the altar. The instructions were detailed for the purpose of putting a difference and a distinction between him and the other demon deities that were worshipped by the surrounding peoples. Every detail, even the minutest detail, is a distinction that sets Yehovah apart. But we must remember, though, that Yehovah was not setting himself apart by being adverse to the practices of the people around him. No, it was they who had become adverse to him, because it was he that had declared himself holy from the beginning. But with the help of demons, the Gentiles had twisted the methods of worship for their own ends and purposes. And it was actually the demons who had for millennia worked to be adverse to Yehovah in the ongoing war for dominance on the earth. So let's make sure that we get that straight. The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it is his. However, he does need for his people to know and understand the innumerable ways that he is holy, distinct, and different from the demons who are warring with him. And he requires that we approach him in the way that he specifies, to show our obedience, to uphold his holiness, and to declare ourselves as distinct and different from the Gentiles, as he declares himself distinct and different from the demons. Now, there are five kinds of offerings that we're going to be learning about, but starting in Leviticus chapter 1, or Vayikra 1, we're going to learn about the burnt offering. Now, the elements of the burnt offering is that there's to be a bull, or a ram from the sheep, or a ram from the goats, or a dove, or a pigeon. And then in chapter 2, we're going to learn about the mincha, or the grain offering, the flour offering. And these are involved in the voluntary act of worship. And so the very first olah or burnt offering that we're going to learn about in Leviticus 1 is the devotional type of offering. This is not the olah or burnt offering for unintentional sin or for purification or for a sin requiring a restitution, which is called a trespass. This is a devotional olah or burnt offering, and it has four aspects to it. First, it's a sweet savor to the Lord. Jehovah's enjoyment of this offering comes because it is a devotional offering. It's an offering from the heart. And two, it is offered for acceptance in the stead of the offerer. Now, that may seem like a simple statement to make, but the animal must represent the offerer. It would not make sense that Jehovah would require his people to burn themselves up to prove their devotion to him. No, he would just prefer that we live to show our devotion again another day. But a life is given, showing him that we are willing to lay down our lives for him. And fourth, this offering is completely burned up. Now, this sacrifice represents what Jehovah wants our heart to be toward him, always burning and yearning until our old sinful heart and nature that we lay on our altar every day are completely burned up, and all that is left is him working through us. Now let's go to Leviticus chapter 1 and start at verse 1. And the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him out of the tabernacle of the congregation, saying. So here we see now that the Lord Jehovah is now dwelling in the tabernacle. And verse 2, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, if any man of you bring an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the cattle, of the herd, and of the flock. Now, all offerings, not just the devotional olah or burnt offering, have certain requirements. And the first one is that the offering must be from the cattle, from the herd, from the flock. Now, why did Jehovah specify that offerings must come from the herd or the flock? I mean, doesn't it just make common sense? I mean, we know that that's where they came from. But why did he have to give that instruction? Well, the reason is because he was calling for specifically domesticated animals. The custom of the surrounding pagans was to sometimes hunt for animals to give as offerings, although they did give of their domesticated herds as well. But it was the hunt among the Gentiles that was regarded as the higher order of the sacrifice. But not so with Jehovah, who is now in Vayikra, defining the difference and making a distinction between him and his people and those demons who are worshipped by everyone else, you see. So there's a big problem when you try to hunt an animal and sacrifice it to the Lord. First of all, there is no control over the condition of the animal. You have no way of knowing if that animal is fit, without blemishes, to be sacrificed. You know, wild animals, I mean deer, for instance, are kosher animals, but would that animal be fit if you killed it? You don't have a way to know until after you've killed it. But there's another reason. A hunted animal has nothing of you in it. It doesn't have your emotional, physical, and time investment in it. And the sacrifices that we bring to Jehovah are to be different than the sacrifices brought by demon worshippers, because our sacrifices are meant to really be sacrifices. So the animals we bring must cost us something. They must cost us a hurt in our heart because of the loss of all that time that was spent rearing and caring for the animal and the potential life that would come from that animal that might have been added to your herd or flocks. Now, I realize that people didn't have really close personal relationships with all of the animals in their flocks, but they would have had a closer, more personal relationship with certain animals that were prized by them because they were blemishless and spotless, you see. And even if they didn't have a real close personal relationship with that animal, that there would still be a sense of loss, a sense of giving that life from the flock. So this sacrifice had to cost you more than, you know, your time running out in the wilderness to go searching for an animal and shoot it with an arrow. You see? So when you selected your prize bull, for instance, you knew that you were sacrificing an animal that could sire many more bovine, and that ram or ewe that you brought could give more life to your flock, and both of these could feed your family as well. So a hunted and possibly blemished animal is no sacrifice at all. And think about this too. More than the relationship that you have with the animal, that animal has come to trust in you. It has probably more of a relationship with you and with than you do with it. So you would be doing to it then what Jehovah later allowed to happen to Yeshua. You know, Jehovah allowed Yeshua to be offered for us. He was led to his sacrifice like a sheep to the slaughter. But the difference is, of course, there that Yeshua decided to lay down his life. He had a choice. The herd and the flock animals did not. And then there is another aspect to the animals being brought from the herd or the flock. The ancient Hebrews would have understood about using clean animals to sacrifice, but we need to be clear that Jehovah's sacrifice can only be from the herds and flocks of clean animals, tahor animals. Now, you may not know this, and maybe you do, but pigs and camels are herd animals too. And later on in Vayikra, we will be given the instruction on the kind of animals that Jehovah deems fit or tahor for his sacrifices, and pigs and camels will not be among them, even though they are herding animals. So for all of the burnt offerings, not just for this particular devotional offering, one could bring a bull or, you know, your ox that you use to plow your field. You could bring a ram from the sheep or a ram from the goats. You could bring a pigeon, a dove, or a grain offering. So you had kind of five options there. Jehovah made it so that no matter what a person's economic status was, he could always approach the Lord. Now, why is this so important? Well, it's because he does things differently. In paganism, most people offered their sacrifices at their homes because of their economic status. You had to be pretty wealthy to go to the temple to offer your sacrifice there. There was a distinction made in those pagan religions between the people who were poor and the people who were rich. But Jehovah makes no such distinction. He makes it so that no matter what your economic status, you may come and do your offering before him. Jehovah does not exclude anyone, you see. So he allows you to bring what you can, whether it's your bull or a handful of flour mixed with olive oil and frankincense. And this is just another reason why the Hebrews no longer had a need to do their sacrifices at their own doors, at their own thresholds. Jehovah has now made a way for everyone to come to Him. You don't get to tell Him to come to you to get His offering. No, He requires you to come to Him. This is just one of the numerous differences and distinctions between Jehovah and the demons who want His throne. Verses 3 and 4. If his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Now, I've been using that word olah, but let's take a look at it. It is the word for burnt offering. Oftentimes, we find that when we translate from Hebrew into another language, and in particular English, we have to use more than one word to express what the one Hebrew word says. So, olah means two words, burnt offering. And so, what is a burnt offering? Well, it is Strong's 5930. Again, the word is olah, and it literally means a step. It's associated with holocaust, as in going up in smoke, but it is also ascent. It's a burnt offering, as I said. It means sacrifice, and it means go up to. And there are a couple of other words that are associated with that. And the first one is Allah, which is Strong's 5927. So Allah is the root word of the word olah. And Allah means to ascend, or intrinsically means to be high, or mount, like as in mounting above. And it's used in a variety of other senses as well that I won't go into right now. But suffice it to say that olah is a step in the direction of Jehovah. Now, if this was called Allah, it would mean to ascend. So with the olah, one does not ascend, but one steps forward. And it is the smoke, then, that ascends. You see, ascension is reserved for the Messiah. When we read of Yeshua's ascension in the Gospels, the Greek word is anabaino. And that is Strong's 305. And it means to arise or ascend or to climb or go up. But it reflects back to the word Allah. It's the same word in Greek as the Hebrew word Allah, to ascend. So do you see how our step forward and the smoke of the olah, burnt offering, and the Allah, Yeshua's ascension, are related? Our personal step forward to perform the olah entails obeying several instructions, you see. So we've already talked about where the animal is to come from, but now we need to look at who it is that is supposed to kill the animal that comes from the herd or the flock. We can find that instruction in Leviticus chapter 1, verses 5 and 6. And it talks about a person called a he. He shall kill the bullock, and he shall flay the burnt offering there. But let's talk about this a little bit, because contrary to the belief of many, the priests did not kill the animal for you. Not only are you bringing your prize and probably much needed animal to the Lord, but now you have to kill it. The priest's job is to just take the blood to the altar. There are, of course, reports in rabbinic literature of priests having to do the killing, but the instruction was actually for the owner of the animal to do it. And the other part of this is that you have to, as I explained before, bring your sacrifice to the door or entrance of the tabernacle. But besides the understanding that we are not to do our sacrifices at our homes anymore, there is another reason that the animal was to be brought to the entrance of the tabernacle, and that was for the purpose of having the priest check the animal and declare it acceptable, as it says there in verse 4. If there is no priest to declare the animal acceptable, then the sacrifice cannot go forward. So the instruction says, "And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering." Now, what's going on there is a transference of your devotion toward the Father into the animal when you press on its head. This is how the animal then becomes a substitute for you. And then the offerer must cut the animal into pieces and wash the inwards, as it says in verses 7, 8, and 9. And the priests then set up the altar and arrange the pieces on it. Now, the inwards include the stomach, liver, kidneys, intestines, and other cleansing organs. And these organs, what they do is filter the blood and create various means of getting rid of toxins from the body. But toxins are not acceptable for sacrificing. That's the reason why they have to be washed before they are burned. That dross, that toxins represent the sin and corruption in our lives. So sin has to be totally burned up, and it will be totally burned up in the end of days, which is the symbolic meaning behind burning up the filth of the animal. And it shows us who will be doing the burning at the end of days as well. And then we go to verses 10 and 11. And if his offering be of the flocks, namely of the sheep or of the goats, for a burnt sacrifice, he shall bring it a male without blemish, and he shall kill it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord. And the priests, Aaron's sons, shall sprinkle his blood round about upon the altar. Now, verse 11 sounds like a new instruction that pertains to just sheep or goats and not to the bull, but that is not quite right. The historical record maintains that verse 11 also pertained to the bulls, so it pertained to all of the animal sacrifices. The north side of the altar is the place of death. That's why we took the animals to the north side of the altars to do the sacrificing there. The animals were not slain at the entrance to the tabernacle. That's where you brought them to present to the priests, and the priest would say that this animal is acceptable. And then they were taken to the north side of the altar where they were killed there. So why do we have this instruction about bringing the animal to the north side of the altar? What does this symbolize? Well, the north is the direction of death, judgment, and destruction. The reason for this is because the north is where Satan wants to be. If we go to Isaiah chapter 14, verse 13, it says, "For you," that's Hasatan, "for you have said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north." Now, destruction comes from the north. If we go to Isaiah 14, and we just read from verse 13, but go down to verse 31, it says, "Howl, O gate, cry, O city, you whole Palestina are dissolved. For there shall come from the north a smoke, and none shall be alone in his appointed times." And then we go to Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 14, where it says, "Then the Lord said to me, Out of the north an evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land. And in verse 15, For lo, I will call all the families of the kingdoms of the north, says the Lord, and they shall come, and they shall set every one his throne at the entering of the gates of Jerusalem, and against all the walls thereof round about, and against all the cities of Judah. And in Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 6, it says, Set up the standard toward Zion. Retire, stay not, for I will bring evil from the north and a great destruction. And in Jeremiah 6, 1, O you children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem and blow the trumpet in Tekoa and set up a sign of fire in Beth Hakerem, for evil appears out of the north and great destruction. Jeremiah 10:22. Behold, the noise of the bruit is come, and a great commotion out of the north country, to make the cities of Judah desolate and a den of dragons. Jeremiah 46:20. Egypt is like a very fair heifer, but destruction comes. It comes out of the north. Jeremiah 50, verse 3, For out of the north there comes up a nation against her which shall make her land desolate, and none shall dwell therein. They shall remove, they shall depart, both man and beast. And in 50, verse 9, it says, For lo, I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From there she shall be taken, their arrows shall be as of a mighty expert man, none shall return in vain. But not only does death and destruction and judgment come from the north, but it is from the north that the Hebrew people shall come from. In Jeremiah 50, verse 41, it says, Behold, a people shall come from the north, and a great nation, and many kings shall be raised up from the coasts of the earth. And in Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 12, it says, Go and proclaim these words toward the north, and say, Return, you backsliding Israel, says the Lord. And I will not cause my anger to fall upon you, for I am merciful, says the Lord, and I will not keep anger forever. So the north then is also a metaphor for the place where Jehovah scattered his people, because the north is the place of death, destruction, and judgment. And when he scattered us, he was scattering us to death, destruction, and judgment. We all know that the Hebrews occupy the entire globe. We're all over this earth. But he calls the place of our scattering the north. And then we have in Zechariah chapter 2, verse 6, it says, Ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, says the Lord. For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, says the Lord. And then you can see in other scriptures where he talks about the Hebrews coming back from the land of the north. For instance, Jeremiah 3, verse 18, and Jeremiah 6, verse 22, Jeremiah 13, verse 20, Jeremiah 16, verse 15, Jeremiah 23, verse 8, and Jeremiah 31, verse 8. And then, when you are already in the land, you fall toward the north when you succumb to your punishment. That is shown to us in Jeremiah 46, verse 6, where it says, Let not the swift flee away, nor the mighty man escape. They shall stumble and fall toward the north by the river Euphrates. You can see more about the people falling toward the north when they are defeated in Jeremiah 46, verse 10. And Jeremiah 46, verse 24, Jeremiah 51, verse 48, and Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 13. And then we come to Ezekiel's ministry. Now, Ezekiel's ministry started with a visit from Jehovah, who came out of the north. Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 4, and it says, "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire." And then we have about the abomination of desolation that will be set up on the north side of the altar where Jehovah's sacrifices are to be sacrificed. And that is shown to us in Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 3, where it says, "And he put forth the form of a hand, and took me by a lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between the earth and the heaven, and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the door of the inner gate that looks toward the north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy." And in verse 5, "Then he said to me, Son of man, lift up your eyes now the way toward the north. So I lifted up my eyes the way toward the north, and behold, northward at the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry." And in verse 14, "Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz." And that literally did happen in history, where the women wept for Tammuz. But let me tell you what, we have brethren who are unwittingly still worshiping Tammuz. Okay, so you see the connection to verse 14, to the end times. And then the judgment starts in the house of the Lord. Well, that judgment that starts in the house of the Lord happens after the abomination of desolation in the north gate area of the Temple Mount. And we can read about this judgment that starts there at the north gate of Temple Mount when the abomination of desolation is set up. You can read about that in Ezekiel chapter 9, verses 2 to 4. And in Ezekiel chapter 38 and 39, we read about the Gog-Magog war that comes from the north. So, I think I've given you enough reason to understand why sacrifices were done on the north side of the altar. It's because death, destruction, and judgment comes there. So let's then now move on and look at another direction that is important in our understanding of the tabernacle. This direction is not mentioned in this Torah portion, but I want to go over it anyway. The tabernacle entrance was on the east side of the tabernacle. Now, some would have us believe this is because Jehovah is the God of the sun, and any other name for the God of the sun is still the same God. Not so. The reason the entrance is at the east is because it places your back to the rising sun when you go to get your animal accepted for sacrifice. You are facing west. Therefore, you are not involved in any kind of sun worship, inadvertent or otherwise, when you are worshiping Jehovah. Now, don't get confused with the fact that we face east when we say the Shema. Solomon proclaimed that everyone should face Jerusalem when praying, and that's why we do this. That is why we here in North America face east. But we are not facing the sunrise. We are facing the holy city that we hope to dwell in someday. So if you are south of Jerusalem, Then when you say the Shema, you face north. That makes you look toward Jerusalem. If you live east of Jerusalem, you would be looking west. And if you live north of Jerusalem, you would face the south when you're doing your Shema. So it's about looking toward Jerusalem. It's not about doing any kind of sun worship. But my point is that we must not allow the enemy to take away the lifting up of our heads toward Jerusalem, because some of us Hebrews that happen to live west of the city must face east when we want to look toward Jerusalem. I am not going to allow the New Agers and the pagans to take away what the Lord has given us just to avoid doing what we were told to do, which is to face Jerusalem. Now, back to what the priests are doing with the sheep or goat, if that's what you've decided to bring. The instructions are in verse 12, and those instructions are the same as for the bull or ox. And continuing into verse 13 again, the instructions are the same as for the bull. And 14, where it talks about that you can bring doves or pigeons, same instruction. Earlier, we learned that we're to bring offerings from the herd and the flock, but we don't often think of birds in the context of the cattle, the sheep, the goats, the bovine, but birds are flocking animals. We talk about flocks of birds, you know. So birds were among the animals that they domesticated in ancient times. Why did they do that? Why were birds commonly kept and domesticated? That's because doves and pigeons were used as messengers. It was common for people to have flocks of birds. Now, not everyone had domesticated flocks of birds, but they would be for sale, you could buy them from your neighbor or whatever. I'm sorry about the phone ringing. I thought I shut that thing off, apparently. Okay, now moving on. So then we get a little bit different instruction about what to do with the doves and pigeons. Doves, of course, are a little bit smaller than pigeons. That's just basically the difference. They're the same species of bird, but doves are smaller than pigeons. And so in verse 15, we learn that the priest brings that bird to the altar, again, to the north side of the altar, and rings off its head, and that head gets burnt on the altar, but he then squeezes the body of the bird so that the blood squirts out onto the side of the altar. And in verses 16 and 17, it gives additional information about cleaving the birds at the wings so that they can be divided but not divided asunder. And so that's what we learn now about the blood sacrifices, the blood olah. But now we're going to look at a different type of olah. We're going to look at the bloodless olah, which is the mincha. And that starts in chapter 2, verse 1. And when any will offer a meat offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour, and he shall pour oil on it and put frankincense thereon. So mincha is Strong's 4503. And the Strong's dictionary says that it's from an unused root, meaning to apportion, that is, to bestow, as in a donation or a tribute, and it's particularly a bloodless and voluntary sacrifice. And so mincha is, as I said, a bloodless offering that is a portion of your grain that has already been ground into flour. Now, how much of this mincha are you to bring? Well, it says that you're to bring a handful in verse 2. And so your fistful, not the three fingers amount called for in the Talmud, but your fistful is the amount for one minchah offering. Now, beyond the fact that the minchah is the bloodless offering, what other importance does the minchah have for us here at the end of days when we don't have a way to do these offerings anyway? Well, this is the one offering that Abba gave us that is bloodless, that allows us to approach him because it is bloodless. Let me explain what I mean. It is the basis for our understanding that it is our prayers, our bloodless sacrifice, that he really wants, because being willing to pray shows that we have a heart for him. Being willing to bring that bloodless spiritual sacrifice shows that we have a heart for him. You see, the mincha is the basis for our understanding that in the absence of the temple, we can be the mincha. We are the bloodless sacrifice by giving ourselves as the sacrifice of prayer. Now, why did Abba include the mincha in these olah burnt offerings? Well, Brad Scott says that the Lord is smarter than we are, and I agree. I think the Lord knew that someday there would be no way for us to do animal sacrifices. In fact, there is no way for us to do the mincha or grain sacrifice either. But he knew that we would be able to understand how to put that symbolism of the bloodless sacrifice to use in our daily prayers when there was no altar to go to. And then further on in verses 3 and 4, it talks about how that the priests are to get the remnant of this meat offering or mincha offering. By the way, I should explain that meat here is not flesh meat. People get confused with that, and I don't know why the English translators use the word meat, but apparently meat back then meant something different than it means now. But the priest gets to have the remnant portion that's left over from the offering. And so what this shows us is that the Lord takes care of the priests by sharing this portion with them. And whereas the devotional animal olah is to be burnt totally and nothing of it is left for the priests, here we see that the remnant of the mincha is theirs. And so there are two types now of mincha that we're going to learn about. One is the kind that you make into an unleavened cake called a challah. We're familiar with that word. Most of us use challah bread every Shabbat. That word challah there is Strong's 2471. And then there is the unleavened wafer, the rakik. And that is Strong 7550. And then we're going to learn in chapter 2 that there are two ways that we may prepare the challah or the rakik. And that is that both of them can be either baked or fried. The word for pan in verse 5 is machabah. It says there in verse 5, if your oblation be a mincha offering in a pan, it shall be of fine flour unleavened with mingled oil. So you can bake it. And then there is another method, which is mentioned in verse 7, that says if your oblation be a mincha offering baked in the frying pan. So there's two different pans mentioned there. And so we have the machabah, which is the baking pan, and then we have the marquechette, which is a frying pan. Now, marquechette is Strong's 4802. So there are two types of menkah and two methods of preparation available to you. And in verse 8, it says, "And you shall bring the meat offering that is made of these things to the Lord, and when it is presented to the priest, he shall bring it to the altar." So again, you bring it to the entrance of the tabernacle, just like a bull or a ram of the sheep or goats, or like a dove or a pigeon would be. The priest inspects it and accepts it. And then he takes it from you and he burns it up on the altar, where it becomes then a sweet savor to the Lord. And then in verse 10 it says, "And that which is left of the meat offering shall be Aaron's and his sons." And so we know that we again are being told that Aaron and his sons will be taken care of. This is their portion, you know. They don't get a portion of the land. Their portion is Jehovah. And so it's up to Jehovah to feed them. And in verse 11 it says, "No menkah offering shall you bring to the Lord made with leaven. For you shall burn no leaven or any honey in any offering of the Lord made by fire." Why no leaven and why no honey? Well, it is because leaven represents corruption. The leaven of the Pharisees is corrupted doctrine. See, there can be nothing corrupt before the Lord. And the reason for there to not be any honey is because honey is an external sweetener. The true sweetness comes from our relationship with Jehovah. Nothing that we add to our offerings can make them any sweeter, since they're designed to bring us into alignment with Him. And being in alignment with Him is what we call the sweet spot, if you know what I mean. Now in verse 12 it says, "As for the oblation of the first fruits, you shall offer them to the Lord, but they shall not be burnt on the altar for a sweet savor." Now that word in verse 12 is for first fruits is reshit, and reshit is Strong 72:25. And if you put a bait on the front of reshit, reshit meaning first in place, time, order, or rank. It also means the beginning. It means chief. If you put a bait in front of that, you get breshit, Genesis, meaning in the beginning. So the reshit korban then is the first of our crop. But this korban, this oblation or offering, is not to be burned. And in verse 13 it says, "And every oblation of your minkah offering shall you season with salt, neither shall you suffer the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your meat offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt." Now there is both a physical and spiritual reason for the requirement to season the offering with salt. Spiritually, the addition of salt symbolizes our agreement to bind ourselves or to be in covenant with Jehovah. A minkah made without salt would be like saying you're willing to do the offering, but you're not willing to be in covenant with Jehovah. And that's just not going to work. We have brethren in the world today who do try to do exactly that by saying they believe in Yeshua as the Son of God and Messiah, but they refuse to perform the works of the covenant, you see? And then, of course, the other reason for the salt is because humans cannot live without salt. The minkah is eaten by the priests, so they need salt for their physical bodies. And again, the salt is a covenant maker, which means then the offerer, the priesthood, and Jehovah are all in covenant with each other. Now, in verse 12, it says that we are not to burn the korban reshit, or the first fruit offering. Well, what that is referring to there is the bikurim first fruit offering that occurs during the week of unleavened bread, according to the rabbis. But then we read in verses 14, 15, and 16 that the first fruit to the Lord is offered for burning, and those first fruits are green ears of corn. So there is a difference between which kind of thing that you're bringing for a first fruit offering that makes it able to be burned or not burned. There are other commentators who say that this here in 14, 15, and 16 does not refer to the bikurim, which is what I was just saying. The bikurim is up in verse 12, but here in 14, 15, and 16, this is not the bikurim. It is simply an additional part that an offerer can bring along with the baked or fried cake or wafer. And this particular part that you bring, if you bring it with your first fruit, your bikurim, then that does not get burned. But this green ears of corn dried by the fire can be burned because it's an offering made by fire to the Lord. And now we're going to look at peace offerings or thanksgiving offerings, peace olas and thanksgiving olas. A peace ola or burnt offering is actually the same thing as a thanksgiving offering. So all that I just taught you was about the devotional ola or burnt offering. But now here are the instructions for the peace or thanksgiving ola or burnt offering. First of all, any clean animal without defect from the herd or flock can be used. And again, this is a voluntary act of worship. It's a to bring thanksgiving and fellowship to the Lord. And this also can include offerings that are offerings regarding vows. So if you've done a vow or taken an oath, this is the kind of offering that you will bring. Now, what goes on the altar? This is different than what goes on the altar with the devotional ola. What goes on the altar is the fatty portions. You know, that fat covering the inner parts of the animal, the fat tail, the fat over the kidneys and the lobe of the liver. And then what is given to the high priest? See, in the devotional ola, the high priest doesn't get any of that. That devotion is 100% for the Lord, so the priest doesn't get any of that. But when you bring a peace or thanksgiving offering or ola, there is a part that gets given to the priest, and that is the breast part goes to the high priest, and then the right foreleg gets to be given to the officiating priest. And so peace and thanksgiving offerings are brought to praise Yehovah when he does something for you. You know, for when he answers your prayer, or when you're just grateful for something that wonderful that happened out of the blue, and you want to show your gratitude because you know that this thing has come from the Lord. Now, chapter 3 details the instruction for each kind of animal brought. And again, this may seem redundant, but what it means for us is that we're to pay special attention to these details. But we're going to go ahead and skip on down to verse 16, where it says, "And the priest shall burn them upon the altar. It is the food of the offering made by fire for a sweet savor. All the fat is the Lord's." And verse 17 says, "It shall be a perpetual statute for your generations throughout all your dwellings that you eat neither fat nor blood." So the fat is the Lord's. And that fat is specific to certain areas of the animal's body. And it does not apply to fat that is marbled in a piece of meat that we eat at our tables, but it does apply if you butcher your own animals, and here's how it applies. If you're butchering your own animal to eat, and you decide you want to eat that part of the fat that's above the kidneys and the liver in that area, that part is forbidden to you. The fat that is normally inside the meat, that is not forbidden. But we cannot eat that part of the fat that goes on an altar, whether we're taking it to the altar or whether we plan to take it to our table. It is forbidden to us. Now, I believe the reason for this is because that type of body fat has a lot of toxins in it. And those toxins are not good for human consumption. And because it has toxins, that means that fat represents the corruption of the person who offers it. And all corruption has to be burnt by fire. That is both a practical and a prophetic application. The fat belongs to the Lord, and so does the blood. And that means neither the fat or the blood gets on your table. If you're going to eat the animal, life is in the blood. So he gets to take the life. We do not. And now we're going to learn about sin korban olas, or sin burnt offerings. This ola in chapter 4 is for unintentional sin. It is in Hebrew, ha kata shagaga. The sin of ignorance. Chapter 4 says, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, If a soul shall sin through ignorance against any of the commandments of the Lord concerning things which ought not to be done, and shall do against any of them." Let me stop right there. I want to let you know that there is no sacrifice in the Torah for intentional, deliberate, defiant, premeditated sin. It is reserved for Jehovah alone to forgive those sins. But even if a person was forgiven for that kind of sin, the consequent required punishment still applied. Now, I know that this is not what many brethren want to hear. They don't want to hear that if you are convicted of adultery, for instance, that you must still be stoned even if Jehovah forgives you and will later let you into the kingdom. You must still die. Why? Because deliberate, defiant rebellion defiles the land. The only way to atone for the defilement of the land is for you to pay the price of your crime. We are out here in the diaspora, the exile, and so we do not suffer the rapid consequences of our sins. And Jehovah does forgive us for these sins, but there are other ways that the consequences sneak up and take something out of our hide for these sins. We never know when we will meet our consequence or what form that consequence will take. So this kind of defiant, deliberate rebellion does have a name. The name of that is called iniquity. That's translated from the Hebrew word avon into the English word iniquity. Avon is Strong's 5771, and it literally means perversity or moral evil. It means also fault, mischief, and the punishment for the sin. So we need to be careful not to permit thoughts of deliberate sinful activity to gain a foothold in our minds and hearts. We have to always be on guard. Now, moving on, in verse 3, starting in verse 3, we're going to learn that it is possible for a priest to cause the entire nation of Israel to sin. And when that happens, there's a special sacrifice for that. It is a much more elaborate ritual than those that we've been learning about before now. But let's go ahead and read, starting in verse 3. If the priest that is anointed do sin according to the sin of the people, then let him bring for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bullock without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. You see, this is one of the ways that the people can sin by accident, by inadvertently. If you've got a leader, a priest, who teaches you something and causes you to sin, it's not your fault. It's his fault. It's her fault. Which is why I try to be very careful about what I teach, because I know I'm going to have to stand before the Lord and give an accounting of the words that have come out of my mouth, and I pray earnestly to not destroy the Lord's word. I pray, please, Father, please, don't let me say anything that is destructive of your word or will cause your people to sin. And in verse 4, it says, "And he shall bring the bullock to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord, and shall lay his hand upon the bullock's head, and kill the bullock before the Lord. And the priest that is anointed shall take of the bullock's blood, and bring it to the tabernacle of the congregation. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood, and sprinkle of the blood 7 times before the Lord, before the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood upon the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall pour all of the blood of the bullock at the bottom of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation." So the priest has these other things that he has to do. He has to actually take the blood of this bull to the table of incense and put the blood on there, which is not something that we saw the instruction for before. He has to sprinkle the blood 7 times in front of the veil, which is inside the tabernacle. And so then he has to pour all of the blood at the bottom of the altar. So these are different instructions than we've had before, because now we're into a whole different requirement, because before we were not dealing with sin. We were dealing with devotion. We were dealing with thanking the Lord for his wonderfulness and his goodness. But now there is kata. There is sin. And so the instructions have to be different. So starting at verse 8, the instructions continue on how to handle that offering up on the altar. And I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to let you go ahead and read those instructions. They're not hard. And so up to verse 12 is the instruction for if the priest sins and causes the congregation to sin along with it. And then we come to how to handle a congregational sin of ignorance following in verses 13 to 21. So once the priest comes to realize he has made a mistake and he atones for the mistake in verses 8 to 12, yes, and then the congregation has to have a sin offering as well, and you can read about that starting in verse 13 going up to 21. And then in verses 22 to 35, we read about the sin of a ruler and how that is to be handled. And then we come to the rules of sacrificing for individuals that commit sins of ignorance, starting in chapter 5 at verse 1 going to verse 13. And then in this is a list of sins that the Lord gives us, from things like concealing the truth when you've been sworn as a witness to speak the truth, to touching anything that is unclean without knowing it, to binding yourself to an oath when you're not able to do the oath, when you're not able to fulfill the oath. And so how would you, if you've been sworn as a witness, how would you not speak the truth? Well, you may think at the time that you were speaking the truth, but you know, our memories are faulty. And sometimes we remember something one way, and then later on we go, oh no, that was not right, you see? And then if you touch anything that is unclean, something could be unclean anywhere in your life as you go through life and you touch it. And then later on somebody says, oh, I saw you reach out and touch that. I'm sorry, I set that aside because it was unclean. And so now you've, you know, that was unintentional. So you understand what I'm saying. Or binding yourself to an oath, which after you take the oath, you find out that you're not able to do this thing. You see, because it's either unlawful to do it or impracticable to do it. So these are the kinds of things, the kinds of sins of ignorance that we're talking about here. Now, the offering for these sins requires a female from the flock, or a lamb, or a kid of the goats. But if the sinner could not afford that, he can bring a dove or a pigeon, as we've said before. So he would go through this process and his sins would be forgiven. Now, starting at verse 14 in chapter 5 are the commandments for the trespass sin. And that is called the Ma'al Kata. Now, Ma'al is Strong's 4604, and Ma'al literally means treachery. That is, it is a trespass sin requiring restitution. A trespass sin requires restitution, but these were and are forgivable, as all sins are. So, what we need to take from this is that there are many ways that the Lord gives us to approach him. It isn't just that he says there's one way to do this and everybody does it this way. No, there are many reasons for us to approach the Lord. There thus are many ways that he says, for this thing, approach me this way. For this situation, approach me this way. Ultimately, it all is to lead to our heart being turned to the Lord, for our devotion to be given to the Lord, for us to be thankful for what he does for us, and to know that he always will forgive our sins. Well, I hope that this teaching has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.